I became an Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm in my mid-60s, so I'm really and truly, I feel younger today than I did that rainy day when I came into the Alcoholics Anonymous ward at the St. Thomas Hospital. During World War II, though, it was a mess inside of me, outside of me, around me, and the whole world was in a mess. You know, as time goes on, I met one of my old friends here, my old friend Bill McNally. And I told him, Bill, I said, you know, it does make you kind of feel old sometimes. I said, looking around, you know, at the ladies at how the old guard is going on to its reward. And I don't believe there's about, I'd say, 8 or 10 that was at the meetings when I first come into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Of course, they weren't coming in too young in them days. And I, coming in as young as I was, I received an awful lot of attention, which today, as I stand before you here on this Sunday night, I'm awful grateful that I got all that attention, which made it possible for me to still be sober and be here tonight. I remember in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, some of the advice and some of the gems that I picked up on the way. And they had told me at that time, after you've had a certain amount of success and sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're convinced there is a better way to live than what you had been living prior to coming to AA, if you want to continue that way, stay active, stay close to AA program, and do the things you're asked to do. So I'm here tonight for two reasons. One reason, I was asked to come here tonight. And number two, I want to stay sober another day. There's only one day at a time that we can stay sober. There are no yesterdays and tomorrow. It's all today. And to me, that's the key to Alcoholics Anonymous way of staying sober. Like you said, my name is Dan Craig, and I'm from Barberton, Ohio. Would you mind bowing our heads in prayer? Our Father in heaven, we thank thee for this beautiful day that thou hast blessed us with, and we thank thee for the privilege of being assembled here this beautiful evening. Our humble prayer is that through this way of life that thou hast made possible for us, may we be ever grateful unto thee and strive to show thee our gratitude day by day by striving to serve a more useful purpose in this world and to help make this a better world to live in. Amen. That was a prayer that I made up as I went along. When I came at the Alcoholics Anonymous program, financially bankrupt, friendless, and spiritualist and everything else, and when I was asked to lead my first meetings in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew I didn't know no prayer. I had no watch. I had a borrow watch, and I had to be find out who in that audience knew how to say a little prayer. So some of the gems that I picked up from the Alcoholics Anonymous way of life is I have my own watch now, you know, and I also have my own prayer. I remember in the early days of AA, we used to have one individual, and he was a very active AA when he was sober, but he had trouble off and on. He recently passed away. I won't mention his name. And I know he has run a hot day, like he'd always say, now that I've convinced you people that I had a coat to match these pants, I'm going to take the coat off and get down to business. Now, my coat don't match, I'm not going to take it off. And I know he had another one when he get up to give a lead. He'd give exactly how many years he's been to Alcoholics a month, and right down to the minute. And then he'd proceed in his talk. Well, I'm not going to do that because I don't know how many minutes it is, but I know it's been quite a while. Like I said, my name is Dan Kirchhoff. I'm an alcoholic, and I feel this way here, and I've been told by the pioneers of the movement who gave so much of themselves for me to make it possible for me to be here tonight, that I'll be an alcoholic till the day I die. So with that thought in mind, in my subconscious mind, I have to just take this thing one day at a time. I have also come to believe that there is no seniority. I have no more seniority tonight in the Alcoholics Anonymous program than a man who stood up and he asked who are the new people coming out to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want that man to feel that him and I are on the same level, in the presence of the same cross for the same cause, an Alcoholics Anonymous fellowship, and stay sober another day. I'll give you a little bit about my background. I'm from the city of Barberton, Ohio, a little bit outside of Barberton, a little old cow bottom valley, you know, the valley of the hunkies, you know, That's where I was raised at. I was born in Akron, and my father being a minister, the three older boys, including me, we started getting kind of rotten in Kenmore. So he picked up the pieces before any more damage could be done and rushed us on the country. This little place, you know, where all the hunkies live, they raise cattle, and they raise goats and chickens. One name, but they raised them. And they also had whiskey still. Some of the best whiskey in this part of the state was made in called Bottom Valley. My father, being a minister, he didn't make whiskey, and he didn't drink it. But the man next door didn't either, because he was a member of my father's church. But the rest of the hunkies, they made hay while the sun was shining. This was bad in them days. They sold to one another. This guy made a better batch than the other guy did, you know. And I can still see that smoke on an early morning coming out of the elderberry bush from the hills, you know. Yes, it was a great time, you know. And, you know, in them days, you know, they used different names to call us the immigrants from here, such as hunkies, walks, dangles, garlic snappers, onion eaters, you know. I know we went to school, you know, with American people, and they didn't have much use for us, especially if we bought garlic sausage in our lunches. But after all, us hunkies, you know, my mom, we raised our own hogs, raised our own garlic, why not? It was cheap in them days, you know. So, you know, they got load up the sausage, you know, and they go to school, American people get a whiff of that garlic sausage, and they tramp and destroy our lunches, and that's something. We got kind of nasty for a while. At one time, it got so bad, you know, we about ready to move back to Europe. If we got excursion rates, but they didn't have excursion rates in them days. So we stuck it out, because I'll tell you why we stuck it out. At that time, you know, from the South came the Southern people, from West Virginia came the West Virginians. And the colored people started coming up here. And, you know, they started picking them and took the pressure off us hunkies. We decided to stay, you know. And we have been thanking these people from the South ever since then for coming up here and making it possible for us to live in America. But that didn't make us an alcoholic, you know. In a big epidemic in 1920, when they was falling on the streets in the schoolroom, I got a bad jolt of ankylosis of the bone and infantile paralysis. And as a boy of 9, I was bigger than my two other brothers. I could hit and run. I could hit them hard and run faster than both of them. And when later I had my schooling in bed, I was to be a cripple the rest of my life. And when I went to our Barberton High School, it was a brown and white. It wasn't a purple and white then days, you know. You could tell how old I am. Come on, brown, come on, white. But now it's purple and white, you know. And I went to the BHS, and you know something? The basketball team wasn't interested in me. I was 4'10". I weighed 62 or 64 pounds at that time. I walked sideways. My right knee popped out. I had to hold it to keep from bumping into people, and I walked sideways. My mother used to bring me to school with a buggy because I couldn't walk that distance. And they made fun of us because we come to work. We did wear Amish outfits, so we come in a horse and buggy. And I also, in high school, the football team didn't want me. I wasn't heavy enough. I couldn't run. Baseball team didn't want me. Even a girl wouldn't play hopscotch with me and jump rope with me. And, you know, when they had any events in school, they looked down at a little hunky walk sideways, and they shunned me, and I shunned them. And at a very young age, I became a rejected boy who felt I was a misfit in this world. And I'd go home and tell my mother about it, and she'd always comfort me. And you know, one day, before I reached age of 16, I worked at the telegraph company. I discovered there was a help for this complex and phobia of mine, of people walking and laughing behind my back, making fun of my physical handicap. And out of the neck of the bottle came the answer to my complex and my phobia. And you know, I didn't know why I didn't start that before, but I was in messenger business, and them days, they couldn't give us cash tips. They give us tips and alcohol. You know, that wasn't bad. And then a quarter, you could buy a pint, half pint, quarter, 50 cents, whatever you had, you sell it. And I used my tip for that, and sometimes I got good tips in the morning. I'd make my rounds, and all the poor people knew me, you know. I was a little rum runner at a very young age. The telegraph man knew where to send Danny at. He knew where to get the best whiskey for the lowest prices. And that was my starting life. All the characteristic defects of a first-class alcoholic and a conniver. And you know, the Barberton High School took a dim view of me going to school smelling from alcohol one rainy day. And 3 months before I was 16, I was expelled from my high school. And that's where my story of my life begins, the road to hell and the road back. And in this room of ours tonight, and throughout this world of ours tonight, you can't find any better qualified individual to talk about the road to hell and the road back And we are the Alcoholics Anonymous Fellowship who are gathered here in Akron, Ohio on this Sunday night. And you know how my road to hell started? It was that night when I went home. I had to face Preacher Joe. And the Board of Education came there that night to tell him what had happened to me, why they had expelled me from high school. And that night, my father was going to show him how the European men rule the roost. He was going to give a demonstration to the American people how the overseas people do it when the kids get out of line. Man, did he give me a demonstration. He broke one big stick on me and used a strap on me and beat me for about an hour and something. And the first time, and the kids were all crying, we had a big family, and that night was the first time in my life I ever defended myself against a stern and strict father of mine. And I reached up and pulled that strap away from him, and I said, Joe, I called him Joe. I said, you'll never live long enough to hit me again. This is it, Joe. And that was a rainy November night when I denounced him and his church and the God he represented in this world to his congregation. And I screamed at him and I called him different things. And I walked out of that room that night and I stood out in front of that house on a rainy November night. I made my own choice, my own decision. I didn't want that straight and narrow path of righteousness. I chose a wide open road. I had a job now and I didn't need Joe and I didn't need nobody in the family. I was to be on my own. And that, ladies and gentlemen, turned out to be my road to self-destruction and the road to hell. And for 18 years, I journeyed on this road down, using alcohol for an escape. Alcohol did something to me that no medicine or no doctor ever did for me. It's with every drink I drank, I seemed to grow taller and I limped less. And when I didn't, I got to where I could hear voices and laughter, then I didn't know if people were laughing at me because I was drunk, or laughing at me because I'm sober, or whether he's talking about me or the man next to me. But soberly as the years went by, I never walked the streets of Barton sober. I'd always walk the alleys and the side streets. I didn't want people to be walking behind me and making remarks about my physical handicap, which I was very sensitive about. And like I said, I used this alcohol for an escape, and it's a crutch. And it did something to me that the doctors had failed to do and medicine had failed to do. And years later, on a rainy day in April, during World War II, when I came through the confines of the alcoholic ward in St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, Ohio, on a hill. And when the whiskey fumes had cleared away and the formaldehyde fumes had died down, but I still had some restraining straps around me and sides of my bed, the awful realization dawned upon me that what I had used for an escape and a help for many years, that this alcoholic crutch someplace, it caved in and left me without support. Do you think I was better after 18 years of drinking? Do you think my physical handicap was better? Tonight, truthfully, I say no. You know something? They're trying to straighten out my hip and my back and my leg. I acquired another handicap between my ears, which my family called nuts. I don't know if your family ever called you that or not. And that was a condition. I realized that alcohol had failed me. I was in worse shape now than I was when I admitted to the alcohol when I first started drinking. You know, as I journeyed on this road down, I became like most alcoholics. I became a conniver, a deceiver, and a great pretender, and a chiseler. I had a brilliant future with a telegraph company, which is out of business now, the Postal Telegraph. And at the age of 19, I was made head man in the city of Barberton. I was headed for the big time for New York, you know, and Cleveland. I had my training. And I was one of the most brilliant men in the IPP, you know. And you know something? I like to take that letter from I got the publicity I got, and I could read in different saloons, and I would let the people know what a big shot I was, as small as I was. And then I seemed to be pretty tall under the influence of alcohol, you know. And when I got fired, I was in one of the Bastilles here in this locality. The company decided they could get along without that publicity, and that's when I got into the food business in the darkest, depression years we ever had. And I had been in the food business ever since then, drunk or sober. And I got to be a success in the food business. I climbed very rapidly in no time at all. I was a top man in the store. And I was a top man in drinking also, you know. And I worked my way up to one of the better markets in town during World War II. And by now my father had passed away. By now I had crossed a thin line on the road to hell. I wasn't drinking anymore because of it's called a physical wreck or a human, misfit. I had all kind of names, you know, for me to call myself, but I didn't want anybody else to call me that name. Many times I came home crying to my mother that people are picking on me and making fun of me. Oh, yes, I went home many times after that when I had no place else to go, when I was broke. We all do that. We find. And my father and I, we hadn't spoke to each other for many years. The only time I spoke to my father when I was under influence of alcohol. And then I read the Riot Act to him about his church, about a God, and what he'd done for me. I know one time I screamed at him so bad, I guess that hurt him to me. He carried the stars to the grave. I said, if you hadn't been so wrapped up in your church, if you hadn't been such a Christian you profess to be, when I laid in that hospital, when the hospital sent me home to die, you could permit a mercy killing, and you could have me put out of the way. And I wouldn't have had to go through what I've gone all these years for the whole world to laugh at me like a circus freak. But you were so wrapped up in your children, in your church, that you forgot about me and your children. I shall never forgive you for this. And I did to him about 2 weeks before he died. We made up about a month. And that's the kind of an attitude there was between a father and a son. All through alcohol and my negative thinking. And you know, one day I crossed this thin line on the road to hell. That's after I got in the food business, and I discovered that I was having an awful lot of trouble with alcohol. I also discovered that this alcohol was putting me in places that I wasn't brought up to be, such as a jail and county jail and different places, you know. I know that's an embarrassing feeling, embarrassing, you know, on Sunday morning when the good people are barking and going to church and I'm laying in the Bastille, hoping somebody would come down and get me out. Well, my father used to come down there and look at me, but never volunteered to bail me out. He'd just come down and let my mother, satisfy mother's worry that I wasn't in a Campfield Hickman funeral home or the Barberton Hospital. And you know, I have scars all over my face and my body, wires and screws and metals, are my grim reminders of my journey on a road to hell. You know something? Time will never erase these scars that I have on my face and body. I'll carry them to my grave. And every now and then I cut myself and I shave and I take a little inventory of the man in the glass. And I have nobody to blame for that but the man in the glass. I put all them scars there. And I also, when I put them scars on my face and body, I put many scars on my mother's heart that she carried to her grave. And my mother, she loved me and I loved my mother when I was sober. In the twilight years of her life when she should have been resting, I said, in our little country home, she was out the mile and a half road, country road, when even an animal would be out through the snows and ice and rain, looking for her son, who would fall along the roadside drunk, Danny. And I come home many nights, this kind of weather reminds me of them December and November nights, when I find her beside the bed, and her prayer was on Serbian, we're Serbians, and her prayer was, God, if my Charlie can't stop drinking, either take me off this earth or take my Charlie. She always called me by my middle name. And I put my arms around her frail shoulders. And I made another promise that was not to be kept. A promise that tomorrow I'll quit drinking. And upon coming in Alcoholics Anonymous, that Tony Bennett song, there's no tomorrow, we find out there's no tomorrow. If we wanted to quit, we had to quit at that time, which I didn't know until coming in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know something? For me to come in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had to lose the best friend I had. Some of us have to have a tragedy, some of us a spiritual awakening, and some of us numerous trips to the Goody Rules, and even to the rolling hills of Stark County, the mental hospital. And for me to come in Alcoholics Anonymous, it was a rough winter that winter, and I came home, and Thanksgiving Day I spent in jail, and in jail, I know that. Next, I got off that Thanksgiving Day and I had Chilliton County beer and then whiskey for Chaser, you know, that was my dinner. And I was condemning the folks at home because I had taken a turkey home before I got drunk and before I got locked up. And I had a little meeting of the doctors and friends of our family. My mother had her second stroke and she can't walk yet for me anymore. And for me to help her out and try to stay sober. And I did that. And I came home on Christmas Eve, 4 below 0, in our little country home. The lights out, the fire's out, the door wide open, and no mother in our house. And the preparation for Christmas was all laid out. I've been sober almost a month now. And that was the night that I found my mother fighting, breathing her last out in the yard. She'd been out for 6 hours, a little over 6 hours. She locked the livestock up at 5, and I found her at 11:15 that night on Christmas Eve, 4 below 0. My mother died the next morning in our local hospital. She never came to. And after this mother of mine, who was the only person who ever defended me, was gone from this world, I felt that this world was empty and that nobody else wanted to understand me or tried to understand me. There wasn't much love between my brothers and myself, and there wasn't much love between anybody as far as I was concerned. And on the second day of January, day after New Year's, I went in a place, I had a bad case of resentment. Now, this will give you something to think about. Resentment and loneliness is something that the doctors and the hospitals and medicine have never had any success in taking out of a human being. We let that get into our system, and we're the only ones that can take it out. And I got such a bad case of resentment toward the doctors and my family, and my mother died like a dog. And then I was resentful toward the Lord. My mother was a Christian, and why did he leave her lay on the yard like that with just a dog beside her? And she's a Christian woman, and she had to die that way. My father was a Christian, and gave 5 years of his best life for serving in a military prison under Franz Josef because he wouldn't shoulder a gun to kill his man. And he had to die with cancer in the lung, caught from the last day he died almost. Is that what Christianity is? Is that what God does to the people who worship him? And if I ever had any idea, thought of worshiping or believing in God, it was removed. And on the second day of January, I took that first drink of alcohol. And I didn't start drinking again as a continuation of the last drink. And if you thought I had trouble on a road to hell until now, you ought to see what happened to me in the next 3 months. I could, I couldn't write a book on it, the people in Harvard could, and my family could fill in. Are you going to title my story, The Rise and Fall and the Comeback of the Second Street Merchant in Barbon? And I could sell a lot of books in Barbon, you know. You know, when I walked on the road to hell, you know, inch for inch and pound for pound, I became the greatest human being hater that ever walked on the road to hell. I used to carry a big, invisible synthetic book. And on it, I divided this book into two sections. The honor list and a hate list, you know. And you know something? Of the 30-some thousand people in Barbon, I think at the end of 18 years, I had all but 5 on that hate list. And I'm telling you, I could really hate people. I hated my employers. I hated the help. I hated the customers. I hated the police officials and the police, and I hated everybody. I didn't like nobody. And you know, the next 3 months, I slept in a supermarket of the store where I work at. And I forgot to tell my employer until he stepped in my face one morning, and I'm sleeping on the floor. You know, now there was nobody cared how long I laid in the jail, how long I laid in the snowbed. You know, they say just before you die, you hear music and get warm. And I woke up and I hear music. Da 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 dee dee dee. Remember that old Salvation Army song? Well, and there it was warm. And I thought, well, I must be in heaven or hell, you know. And it was the Salvation Army barking. It dug me out of a snowbank around Christmas time. And they were praying for me and playing music for me. That night I made a promise that they'd give me warm soup and coffee, that someday I'd come to the Lord and I would be a member of the Salvation Army. And I have never got around to it yet. I'm postponing alcoholics, you know. And you know something? One morning, you know, as a good citizen of Barberton, we're going to church like a good citizen do. They all stopped at this big supermarket on 2nd Street, because in the supermarket display window was laying a manager. Monkey Dan, dad drunk with a no shame, a big white bloody coat on, and a tomcat sleeping on his chest. And you know, I didn't know where I was at first, but I rolled out of that window, rolled behind the checkout counter, and finished my nap, you know. By now, I had no self-respect, respect of my family, respect of anybody. Oh, also, the family took a little time out, not to do me good, not to commend me, but to condemn me no more. They probated me. You know what probation is? That's one step away from the Summit County Jail and 130 miles away from Ohio State Penitentiary if you violate the probation. I was appointed administrator of this large estate of the family because I was the only businessman in the family, you know. And I didn't know that the only bar I knew about was a Portage Grill bar and rest of the bar downtown. But the law bar ain't knowing about it. Being administrator, you can sell this stuff and buy whiskey with it, you know. So I take the mattresses and pillows and load them up in international truck, our old radio, and I peddle it off. And then one day I shoveled 10 pounds of coal out of the cellar and sold it for 20 bucks, and me and this guy drank the money up. Or catching chickens at night, you know. Oh, we had a farm. And you ever see a drunk chasing chickens by 2 o'clock? Waking them up first, you know. And I sell these chickens, whatever I get for them, sell the haystacks. And the family thought best to put Danny under probation. You know, it's a big family, 9 of us. And, you know, I thought, well, I'm administering. Let me get my fees first. If there's anything left, well, they can get the rest, you know. You know, I also had my after they probated me, I put him on this hate list, too. You ready? And when the Alcoholics Anonymous came after me on the floor of this supermarket I sleep with at, I had no other way to go. I had gotten, I'd say, on the road to hell, many of us get to the portal, right to the door to hell, and some of us get to the last crossroad before we enter the portals of hell. I believe the reason we're here, somebody in this fast-moving, commercialized, materialistic minded world of ours took time and gave themselves and talked to us and told us there's a better road to travel than this rough road to hell that we're traveling on. And that's the road of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I believe that my mother's prayers were answered when it came to me on a rainy day. And I'll tell you who came after me. A man that I had on his hate list. I didn't like the sight of him even. He'd been sober about a year. He did business with me, and I thought he'd cheat me all the time. I didn't trust him. He's prospering so much. He's still prospering today. And when they took me to St. Thomas Hospital, there was not too much argument. The boss said, get him out of here. Now, we had 6 men working the store and 10 girls. And out of the 6 men, 3 of us went in Alcoholics Anonymous inside of a year. I think that's batting 500. I think that's a good average. But the boss didn't think so, you know. And the oldest one, Frank, he passed on, still sober, which he did that about a year on me if he's living the day. And he stayed right sober from the day the Lord called him to go home. And when they took me up there, it's about 8-mile trip. And the reason I went to the St. Thomas Hospital, I had reached the end of my journey. The only way I could go now, I had gone up. I had no friends. I was on probation. I was in the office of the police department in Barberton. I had 3 DWI charges against me. I had 28 violations. They took my driver's license away, and last night they took my license plates away. You know, I get this mail from Columbus, a big long white envelope, to slow down at sundown. The State Bureau of Vehicles. I didn't bother opening up because I knew what it was, you know. And I was in an awful condition. I know my boss, he said to me, he always called me Kirch because we had 3 Dannys down there. He said, Kirch, I owed him enough money now. It wasn't a payday, just exchange day down there. He was my legal advisor, my employer, he paid my bills, and I slept in the store, and he didn't charge me none for that. And I didn't eat, so he knows I need no merchandise, but who eats? Well, maybe chili con carne for breakfast. The reason I like chili con carne, I take a double order of chili con carne with 2 teaspoons full of cayenne pepper in it. And if I could taste the heat of that cayenne pepper, I knew I was alive yet. And then I start that whiskey and beer, you know. And then that would kind of keep me going till noon, you know, till I got a break. And it was that kind of a situation when Alcoholics Anonymous came after me. And I didn't go into St. Thomas Hospital then, because I wanted to secure my job. During World War II, well, I got fired 364 times unofficially, and I quit 368 times. I used to quit sometimes 5 times a week. I had a mimeograph, my resignation. And all I did was just have it signed and put on his desk, and then pass out on the floor of the store, you know. But he couldn't fire me because I owed him money, and if I quit him for keeps, I couldn't drink no more. Because they'll be sponsoring my drunks, and there I was between the devil and the deep blue sea. And they took me to St. Thomas Hospital, and I went in there because nobody else wanted me. I like the way Alcoholics Anonymous took me. You know, when I went in the AA program and they came after me, they didn't ask me what nationality I was. They didn't ask me what religion I was. They didn't ask me how much dollars I got in the bank, or what kind of people I associated with. They asked me, do you want to quit drinking? They explained to me that I'd never been called an alcoholic. It's always been a drunk on a police blotter, you know, drunken Danny, hunky Danny, you know. But now this fancy name of an alcoholic, you know. I said, now, how do you know I'm an alcoholic? They could be able to say, well, the record proves there's something wrong with you. You're not normal right now. And, you know, I didn't go in there to secure my job, and I didn't go to pacify anybody. Because I'll tell you what, I was in no pacifying mood. With this big list I had, I didn't like the colored people. I didn't like the white people. I didn't like the Jews. I didn't like the Protestants. I didn't like the Catholics. You name it, I was against it. Until I became anti-Danny. I didn't like to see what I saw in a looking glass. The man looked back at me. It wasn't what I used to look back at when I first started shaving. It was something different. I used to think somebody's looking over my shoulder, you know, and the nose is kind of changing colors, you know. And then red veins was appearing in the face, you know. And kind of a bloated looking, you know. I wore dark glasses 7 years prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a pair of regular glasses under it, and I didn't know that one of the lenses was missing until I sewed it up. You know something? I always walked on the lonely side of the street, the dark side of the street, like I was looking for money. I wasn't looking for money. I just didn't want people looking at my face. They used to say to the boss, "What makes his eyes like that?" Boss said, "Dan, wear them glasses, dark glasses all the time." I'm getting tired of answering them questions. I had such a bloodshot eye, you think it just had a transfusion. I had bags upon bags upon bags, you know. And he said, "Please don't take." And I slept with them. I lay in jail with them dark glasses. And I never knew the lens of my real glasses was missing one of them. And that was a condition that Alcoholics Anonymous took me to St. Thomas Hospital. And I'd say I went in there not to secure my job or pacify or get money. Probate court had everything tied up. And I didn't go in there. I didn't have the clothes with us. You see, in my condition, I was not invited to any social function. You know what I mean? There was a party going on. I wore out my welcome all over. I know this today. I rapped on the doors of my sisters. I was always telling them what I thought of my brother. And the minute I get on that porch, the lights would go out. I could hear them just crying. And I could hear the radio playing. We didn't have TVs in them days. Very few. And I used to stand and curse and scream when they called the police to get me off a porch. And that's the kind of friendly feeling that people had toward me when I come in Alcoholics Anonymous. But like Alcoholics Anonymous, as I was. I had my first bath in the alcoholic ward after they took the restraining straps off on me. And you know, I was impressed about the kind of the people that come to see me. One of the early people were there, most of them have passed on here. This fellow here was a very wealthy man. Not too far from here. And he talked to me, and I could tell by the cut of his clothes that he did sleep under the bridge. And he had a suit of clothes, just fit him like a glove. And his hand didn't shake. And he says to me, "Would you have a fair cup of coffee?" We didn't have mayors then. Them days we were around the hall and we had a little kitty for coffee. And he said, "Look at that hand," he said. "How steady that is," he said. "A year and a half ago," he said, "I had to pour my coffee in a saucer and lap it up at the tap. My wife and I had come in Alcoholics Anonymous just to try for a year, but we liked him on his day. And he died sober. And you know, he was a man, a wealthy man, you know, a manufacturer. And another man came to me and a Dr. Bob and Sister Ignatia. And I can stand here and tell you of the pioneers of Alcoholics Anonymous, many who had their life stories in a book one of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they give of themselves and talk to us six or seven men in the alcoholic ward. And it rained every day I was there. And I had the blues. And they kept telling us day by day. And you know, the awful realization dawned on me. And I feel about this way here today. You know, when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me that this Alcoholics Anonymous program was absolutely free and mine as long as I wanted. And if I accept this program without reservation, as it is, the four absolutes and 12 steps and the 24-hour program of faith and a power that is far greater than us, that I have everything in the world to gain and nothing to lose. That was during World War II. This is the year 1975. A lot of water had went under the bridge. A lot of drinks had went over the bars where I used to drink. And should I toy with the idea tonight, between here and Barbara, that I need a drink of alcohol, you know, I'll sum it up this way. I'll compare it. With the first drink of alcohol I take tonight, it's a reverse situation what it was when I came in. I have everything to lose and nothing to gain. And I'm not talking about the automobile I drive and a nice home I live in and a lovely wife I have and a different material thing that I'm mine to use just for my duration in this world. But I'm talking about the priceless gems that I have picked up on my journey on the road back, such as my self-respect, the respect of my family, the respect of people I work for, the respect of people I do business with, the respect of my church people, the respect of our ministers, and respect of many people. You know something? With the first drink I take, I stand to lose all that. This money cannot buy. I had to earn that. I had to earn and work for the respect of people. You know, and something else that I have learned to be dependable and honest. I found out that honesty plays a great part in our sobriety. You know, it's a nice feeling when you take a set of keys and put in a half a million, open the door of a half a million dollar business. And at the close of the day, when you're trusted with all that money, lock up a safe and put all that stuff away, and you're trusted with that. You know? And all these people dependent on you to get inside that place. And should I fail to appear that day drunk, all these people will look at me in a different light. It's wonderful of a gem that I had picked up in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I didn't have too much success in my first year. Sister Ignatia, like I said, I was young. And I had got a lot of attention. But you know, the last day I was there, it's raining, I'm going to my first meeting. And as I headed for Barton, for my first meeting in Akron and Barton, I thought, what if somebody calls me Crip or Limpy? And already I'm getting ahead of the day-by-day program. And you know, I stayed in AA a little while and I graduated. And I graduated. And when I came to, it's belt buckled for aldehyde shackles again. And you know, that formaldehyde weight, it kind of gets to you, you know. St. Thomas cocktail. The second time they isolated me out of a little place out where that Haven home is on the lakes here, $14 a day. You know what my hospital deal with? I'll tell you, it's the story of inflation. I was in St. Thomas Hospital, 6 days. My hospital bill was $42. I thought that's awful high. And you know, I was ashamed to tell my insurance company about it, so I had borrowed the money for a pause and payment. And about a week after I got out of the hospital, they came down to check on me why I didn't report. I didn't know that they had an MIB, a medical information board. They can find out who's an alcoholic. He said, why the heck did you tell us you're an alcoholic? I said, I thought everybody knew it. Anyhow, to make a long story short, I come out of St. Thomas Hospital. I had a little trouble early. But my last drunk was in City Hospital, and I'll tell you why I'm here tonight. You know, the reason that most of us are is because somebody helped me and somebody took time out. And somebody's prayers were answered. When I went to City Hospital to put my first artificial hip in, I was there 118 days. And on the 76th day, they told me some news I didn't like. And I was an ideal patient. There were 525 of us there. And the 77th day, the self-pity resentment got in my system. And out of 525 people in that city hospital, guess who got drunk? Member of Alcoholics Anonymous, little hunky Dan from Barton. What got me drunk? Self-pity and resentment toward the doctors, because I said I'd stay another 100 days. And when they come found me, I was trying to go down a stitch in a wheelchair. That orthopedic ward had rules against orthopedic patients crashing down the steps in wheelchairs, which I had ever read that in fine print. Then when I come to, guess what? Dan Kirchhoff is shackled to his bed, room 416, S416, buckles, belt, paraldehyde, and shackles. I'm one of the few members that's alive of Alcoholics Anonymous. And actually, you can tell about it, that I've had paraldehyde on both hands, and it works. And for 18 days, that little hellraiser from Barton almost took the roof of the city hospital off. They had the flag flying at a half mast, I think, the last couple of weeks I was there. And when I got out, they said, but I never got out till I did something, and I'll never forget. When one of the nurses, a friend of the late Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob is a good friend of mine, I didn't know it, she brought Dr. Bob in to see Dan Kirchhoff shackled to the bed in the city hospital. I'm glad I was passed out when he came in there. I've been ashamed to see him. And I want to tell you this. The reason I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody took a little time out and called me. And you know who called me? This little sister of nature took time out to put her finger in that telephone number and call me on City Hospital, City Thomas Hospital, City Hospital. And she told me this. Dan, I have heard about your misfortune. She didn't call it drunk. My family called it drunk. And I have called you this day, on this beautiful Sunday, to tell you to get the faith that you had when you went into a city hospital, read the book of AA, and pray to God. And tonight, I and the sisters of St. Thomas Hospital, I'm going to say a prayer for you. God bless you and call you again. And the next day in the city hospital, when the sun rose over through my window there, flat on my back under a pair of heavy trapeze. Dan Kirchhoff had his last drink of alcohol flat on his back. And when he brought that whiskey to me, I was getting whiskey by the half water glass. I told him, leave the bottle there, and I won't bother the nurses. You know, that's a lot, because here's what they did. Every now and then they'd be late. They were never late with the enemas, you know. But here was my whiskey, my medicine, too. I called Superintendent Howard Worth one morning at 15 after 2 at his home, woke him up, to tell him as a paid-up patient at the city hospital, paid in advance, I don't like the kind of treatment I'm getting here. And he said, what kind of treatment? I said, my medication's late. I didn't tell him what kind of medication it was. He found out later. And when this nurse come in, found out I had called him, she said, this is a holy day, and if you think I'm going to serve you whiskey, Mr. Christian, you've got another guest coming. She said, I'm a Christian. I said, I have your job, and I have your cap, and I have your badge. Yeah, I told her that, you know. And I said, I hope you marry an alcoholic. I hope you have to get up every hour on the hour when he starts shaking the bed vibrates. He has to get a funnel and a fifth and pour down his throat so the bed stops shaking. That's what I hope for you. And when that sister Nisha called me up, I had my last drink of alcohol. And I did something then I should have done. And this is good advice to the new and old people. Is a searching, fearless, deep down inventory, not of our sponsor, our wife, our minister, our elders, or the priest, but of our own selves, the man in the glass. Before you can become honest with the rest of the world and your family and Alcoholics Anonymous, you must learn to become honest with a man in the glass, and that's the man you're staying sober for. He's the most important individual in your life. You got drunk for him, now you're staying sober for him. And you must have the desire for sobriety stronger than that desire for that first drink you ever had when you got up in the morning. And I took a little inventory of myself, and I didn't like what had come up. And it was that day that I realized why I got drunk. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous in the first year, you know, and I had a kind of a loose hold. They said, take a hold of two handles and hold on tight. And I took a hold only one hand, kind of a loose hold. And you know why I couldn't take a hold of two hands? I had that big book I told you about, and I still put names on that hate list. I also had with me a big bucket of crap, a 20-gallon jar. And you know what kind of crap I had in there? Like most of us out there, you accept Alcoholics Anonymous on our own terms. Such a thing as resentment, reservations, hatred, egotism, and self-sufficiency. And I thought someday I would need the meetings. I don't need God. I don't need anything. I'll be the master of my own destination. That day in the city hospital, I took that big bucket of crap and I shoved it under the bed. And I took that big book and I shoved that under the bed. And I reached up and took a hold of these two handles, the trapeze, above my bed. And I said the first adult prayer in my life, God, forgive me for what I have done. God, give me another chance. I want to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to live the kind of a life that thou has put us on this earth to live. And the Almighty God, you know, we believe as we journey on our road back that there is a God. And the same God that was trying to keep us from destroying ourselves as we journeyed on our road to hell is with us today as we journey on our road back. And I feel tonight that the God is not frowning upon this gathering here tonight. He has never frowned on the gathering of Alcoholics Anonymous. But he has frowned on many things we did as we journeyed on the road to hell. And I talked to this God as best I could. That was my last drink. And you know something? I took a hold of this AA program, and I've been holding on ever since. And late that fall, I started walking. And 6 times in my adult life, I had to get out of a sick bed and learn to walk all over again. And every time it gets more difficult. I like to compare the things that God gives us, the wisdom, the talents, and the good health. You know how we appreciate them more? If we have the misfortune to lose them and then get them restored to us again, we appreciate them much more than a man who never lost them. As we of the Alcoholics Anonymous Fellowship walk on a road back today, dedicated to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and a service to others, and having turned our wills and lives over to a power greater than ourselves, we come to believe in God. We feel this way, that God wants us to do the best we can with what he gives us and what's left to do it with, you know. And you know something? That day when I started walking, I realized how wonderful it is to walk and how wonderful the fall air was. And you know something? The realization dawned on me the first few steps I took with these heavy metal crutches under my arms and these heavy casts around my leg, this awkward silver hip inside that never bends. It's not mobile. All this contraption in me, on me, around me was at one tenth as heavy as that bucket of crap and that essence that I had carried all my life. So, ladies and gentlemen, members of Alcoholics Anonymous, unburdened by the unnecessary burdens that I had burdened myself all my life, I was now walking on a road back of Alcoholics Anonymous, which we continue to travel day by day, which we call our highway of possibilities unlimited. The joys that we receive day by day, the blessings that the Lord showers upon us by staying sober and doing His will and helping others. I felt this way. In my first year, maybe a couple of early years, I used to be high, I used to be low. When things are going my way, everything's all right. When things didn't go my way, maybe I lost a baby or did sponsoring or something, right? But you know, as the years have passed by, I have got some of the serenity that we say in this little prayer. And I have learned to travel the happy medium, the middle road. And if we take that middle road, the happy medium, we'll get the things that are promised us in the Alcoholics Anonymous, and the Lord's promise of peace of mind and contentment. And I don't want to tell you that the sun's been shining for me every day, almost 30 years now. I've had some setbacks, sickness, financial setbacks. But my worst days on the road back was better than any day I had on the road down the hill. And this story has a good ending. I've been back here for many years. And in 63, when I almost left this world and the Lord spared me, when they had interdenominational rights for me in the Barberton Hospital, I broke this precious silver hip. Staph infection set in, pneumonia, and I was ready to leave this world. And they couldn't get a hold of our men. I got to watch my thinking every day I live. It's positive thinking and only for today. And when I come out of that hospital in diabetic sweats, I saw a lovely woman in a restaurant one day. She went there. I went to see her again. And I courted her for when I married her. And my Catherine and I have been married soon be 11 years. I got married very young. I was only 53 when I got married. That is legally, you know. And what I lacked in that empty bachelor's apartment and four walls and the ceiling, Catherine has given it to me. And Catherine and I have been getting along wonderful. Catherine would come to the meetings. Neither one of us smoke, and Catherine can't stand tobacco. Her eyes water for 3 days after she gets smoked. And smoke gets in your eyes, you know. But she always sends greetings to the members of AA. She loves Alcoholics Anonymous. She loves the people in it. She knows they're nice people. And I love Catherine. And a year ago, 14 months ago, I had a quick working. And when I had a little incident in Florida, my good leg, my bread and butter leg, caved in on me. And when I was in Florida, I had a little trouble down there. And you know that song, "It's No Secret What God Can Do"? Therefore, let God come in our system. We lost our little poodle dog down in Florida. He's just like a child for us. And I'll tell you how the Lord works. I was always a friend of the church, but never a member. I came to the Lord with my whole heart. And you know what? We get down Florida the last night we was there. They had everybody in Anna Marie Island looking for this poodle dog, Pepe, with a black blue collar. They had him on radio, TV, newspapers, and everything. No Pepe. We left Florida. And the last night we was there, my wife is Catholic, and I'm Protestant. And she was down on her knees, and she was praying, and I was walking and praying, and I said to the Lord about how much I'd like to have that dog. And I said, if anybody got him, give him a good home. But better yet, I'd like to have him back. And only a miracle bring him back. And then I hesitated. And I said, only God performed a miracle, God. Because this room is full of miracles that God performed. And I said, God, if that dog does come back, if we get him back, I hesitate. I'm going to dedicate my life to you. I'm going to come to you in full. I'm going to give you my heart, God. Never thought I'd have to do it. 3 days after we got home in Ohio, that telephone rang. And our dog was found in Anna Marie Island. I was sick. And they packed him up and put him in a plane and shipped Pepe home to us. And I still didn't believe in God on that, you know. And when I went to the airport, I still didn't believe it's the right dog to be parked there. And as I lay in the home, I was sitting in a chair waiting for it to go to the hospital. It dawned on me, oh my gosh, what did you promise the Lord? And I went and was baptized, I talked to the elders. And the night I was baptized in the Apostolic Christian Church, our new church wasn't completed. They came from all over Ohio and Pennsylvania to see the minister's son. I was the first member of Alcoholics Anonymous, baptized in the Apostolic Christian Church. And I went to the City Hospital, and again they sang for me that night. I cried, "Will God be with you till we meet again?" And then City Hospital, Akron General, when they took me apart here and put this new hip in me, I knew that Jesus was with me, and the prayers of AA, and the prayers of the church and the family. And with all these things going for me, just before the lights went out for me surgery, I knew that this operation would be a success. We got to have that faith. As they taught in AA, faith without works is dead. These are the gems, these are the things that I have got since I've been an Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I journey on the road back day by day, my program of living is this. Direct communication with God every morning and every night. And just before I came here tonight, I went down here in my closet. And I got down on my knees. And my prayer was that God would be with me here. And that God would put words in my mouth tonight that I may say something to be of some help to these wonderful people at Alcoholics Anonymous, especially to the new man. And as I feel this way here, at the twilight years of my life, I don't know how long I got to be here, only God knows. Whatever time I got left, I don't want to abuse it, I want to use it. And what I want to do with the years of God, the days of God has left, you know, like Sister Nation say, you say God doesn't. We're only one heartbeat away from eternity. When God's going to call us, I don't know. But I feel this way. When the Lord does call me to go home, my one most fervent prayer is this. When the Lord calls me and I go over that great divide to the horizon far beyond, may I leave the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, which has been my life for a past few years and few decades, in a far better frame of mind and condition than when Alcoholics Anonymous found me in Barberton, Ohio, in that supermarket on a rainy day in April. May I leave all you wonderful people in a much better frame of mind and condition than what you found me and my respective family, what's left of them, and my old and new friends. And I, with a wave of the hand and saying, God, I have done the best I can for what thou givest me. And there's the one concluding request I have tonight, which I always like to say before I close, is tonight, when you go to your respective home, God be with you, Lord's home. And if you do what I do every night, get down on your knees and have a nice talk with the Lord, and give him thanks for another day of sobriety and this better way of life and for the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the conclusion of your prayer, I want you to ask yourself one question. If you can look in the mirror, where would I be at tonight if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous? Thank you, one and all, and may God bless, and may God be with each and every one, and may each and every one of us continue to travel the road back of Alcoholics Anonymous.